From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week we're joined by New Orleans singer-songwriter PJ Morton. He's a member of the pop group Maroon 5, but his solo work is indie soul brilliance.
You got nothing to do with that. Nothing to do with that. Nothing to do with that.
And we will review the inescapable album of the summer, the cultural zeitgeist moment that is Drake.
That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we have a great in-studio performance from New Orleans-based soul singer PJ Morton. But Greg, first, we have to deal with Drake. He is inescapable. He is ubiquitous. This is the album of the summer. Whether you think you want to hear it or you don't, you're going to hear it. What do we think at Sound Opinions of Drake's Scorpion?
Kiki, do you love me? Are you riding? Say you never ever leave from beside me.
Greg, we have got to talk about Aubrey Drake Graham. His fifth proper album, depends on how you count, there were mixtapes, is called Scorpion. It is breaking every record that exists in the music industry to break at the moment. 170 million streams on day one on Apple Music, 132 million streams on day one on Spotify. Billboard was sort of conflicted about is Drake therefore the biggest rapper of all time. Since the sale of measurable physical product has disappeared, it's a thing of history now, how do you measure how much an artist is being heard? Streams, obviously, are one way. I looked up what the physical product album sales for Drake were. So far, it's 160,000 copies.
Yeah.
That's absurd to me. You and I, when we were covering the last big heyday of the physical music industry, CDs, Eminem, Britney Spears, NSYNC, they were selling 8 million copies a week.
Yeah, millions.
You know, and Drake is at 161,000. It is inescapable. Is it worth that attention? I guess that's the question we want to tackle on Sound Opinions. I really enjoyed Drake's first album, so did you, when we reviewed Thank Me Later, when he first burst out of the 406. Toronto native, was already a star, but for television. He was Jimmy on Degrassi, The Next Generation. And then he turns to hip-hop in a big way. You know, my take, Greg, is that after Thank Me Later, which I really enjoyed, there's been a sharp drop off in his work. He's kind of given us the same thing over and over again. The adjectives repeated by all of our critical sisters and brothers again and again. Self-obsessed, solipsistic, boastful, aggrieved. He's the champion of self-pity. All right, this is an incredibly ambitious record. 25 tracks, 90 minutes, 32 producers had some role on this record. I happen to think it is his strongest record since Thank Me Later. But with qualifications, I also think it's too damn long. I think it should be only a third of what it is. He positioned it as half of an R&B pop album, that's the second half, and half of a rap album. Half, that first half, him taking on some of the people who have aggrieved him. And, you know, just one look at the song titles, there's always people who've made Drake feel aggrieved. Can't take a joke, I'm upset, jaded, all right?
Serving up a pack, serving up a pack. Pulling gimmicks because they scared of rap. Funny how they shook, they got them shook. Pulling back the curtain by myself, take a look.
This kind of part of his shtick, half of it is about the men who've made him angry or who put him down. The second half about the women. I think the key track is called Is There More? You made me think a couple of weeks ago, bringing up Peggy Lee's 1969 hit, Is That All There Is? Right?
Yeah.
You know, and it's the great existential question pop song of all time. Drake, at his best, asks those existential questions. Is that all there is? I am rich. I am famous. Am I loved? Is that all there is?
Is there more to life than digits and banking accounts? Is there more to life than saying I figured it out? Is there more?
At his worst, he kind of flips it and says, this is all I got, you know. But he ends the record, the last words on this incredibly long record, 25 tracks, 90 minutes, I'm changing from a boy to a man.
I'm all alone, no one to cry on. I need shelter.
What does that mean? He's 31. He just had a child that he only confessed having because Pusha T, in one of those, you know, modern day hip hop beefs, he's feuding with Kanye, he's feuding with Pusha. Pusha outed him as being a dad and not having a child he lived up to. Now he does, which is pretty brave. He is now, according to Billboard, right on that list with Kanye West, Kenny Chesney, Madonna, U2, and Eminem as one of the biggest selling artists of all time. So any personal confession is brave. You know, I just always wish he had a little more. There is a great third of an album in here.
Well, I think it's a – I actually think there's something to – the fact that this man is so successful indicates to me that he's connecting with a lot of people out there. I think one of the reasons is that he's been able to do that. He's so big on social media. He's an Instagram king. And he's able to sort of communicate in a way that Instagram crowd understands. He's speaking to them on Instagram, and he's basically reflecting their lives back at them. These sort of rituals of hustling, being a playa, you know, going out there and hooking up with a partner, a lover, those sorts of games that are being played on social media, he's basically expanding that here on the social media.
Don't link me, don't hit me when you hear this and tell me your favorite song. Don't tell me how you knew it would be like this all along. I know the truth is you won't love me until I'm gone. And even then the thing that comes after is moving on. I can't even
the thing that I think is missing from Drake and why I found him so appealing up through Take Care, his 2011 album, the vulnerability. He was willing, I think he was a fresh voice in hip-hop for a number of years, for the first three records, where he was talking about the fact that I'm a flawed person. I'm having a real problem dealing with the fact that I'm becoming this hip-hop star and I'm not doing really well at it. He was admitting that he was flawed. I think what I'm seeing from Drake, especially on Views' 2016 record and now this one, is a more guarded Drake, less willing to come out and discuss the fact that, yes, I am weak, I am vulnerable. We see it emerging on that March 14 track where he's talking about what it means to be a father and this whole notion of becoming a man from a boy. And I'd love to see more of that. That said, the production on this album is incredible. There is an incredible array of hooks on this record. He has turned into a pop machine. I mean, you talk about all the singles he has on the charts, you know, that he's dominating the top 10. Every one of those songs has a hook in it. There are a few duds. The consensus dud on this record is I'm Upset.
I'm upset. 50,000 on my head is disrespect. So offended that I had to double check. I'ma always take the money over. That's why they need me out the way what you expect.
It reminds me of the Dave Matthews phenomenon in the 90s when a point of commonality among white American youth in the 90s was Dave Matthews.
I got to see a Matthews
gotta,
show.
You got to see, because my friends are all going.
Right.
And I think with Drake, it's that sort of thing. And you could say, okay, Lemmings, you know, they're just following the leader, so to speak. But there is something about the music that is connecting those people, and that is a powerful thing, and it should not be dismissed. One thing I admire about this guy is he's remained loyal to these guys he started with, Noah 40, Shabib, and now Boy Wonder.
A great
producer.
They've
created the sounds. Yeah. These guys have created sounds around this guy, and they built an industry around that Drake sound. He's got one of those most recognizable voices in hip-hop history, but the production around him is equally smart and equally distinctive. And as you said, he's expanding out and starting touching on all these genres, you know, whether it's trap or New Orleans bounce. You know, he's giving you a flavor of each of those things. So well, there's, a certain wallpaper quality
there
about
is,
it.
But then at his best, there is something. So what we thought we would do for our listeners. All right, you want to understand Drake. You know you should understand Drake, but you don't want to deal with 90 minutes, 25 tracks, 32 producers of Drake. Nice for what?
Everybody get your roll on. I know shorty and she doesn't want no slow song. Had a man last year, life goes on. Haven't let the thing loose, girl, in so long. You been inside, know you like to lay low. I've been peeping what you bringing to the table. Working hard, girl, everything paid for. First, last phone bill, car, no cable.
For me, that song, Nice For What, we both agree. Nice For What is a standout track, and he does it with a really interesting sample.
Yes, he does. He's used a number of name artists here to duet with, in the case of Michael Jackson on Don't Matter to Me, and Mariah Carey is the central voice in Emotionless, a sample of her music, and sampling Lauryn Hill on Nice For What. Lauryn Hill, her debut album, which, by the way, very timely, 20th anniversary of The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, her solo debut. She's never really done a proper follow-up to it. Now she's doing a 20th anniversary tour where she's going around performing the album from start to finish. An important album for a couple of generations of young people who grew up in that era and are now coming of age and making their own music, as in Drake's case. The Lauryn Hill song that's being sampled for Nice For What is X Factor from that record. Nice For What is—it's an interesting song because it's got that New Orleans feel to it. He's got the Big Timers. He's interpolating lyrics from the Big Timers, that New Orleans duo, on it. He's got Lauryn Hill from The X Factor, this emancipation song. I'm breaking free. I'm doing my own thing. The X in X Factor is Wyclef Jean. Yeah. She's breaking away from the Fugees. She's creating her own thing. This is a very powerful statement of a woman going out on her own. And here, I think very appropriately, in Nice For What, is that Drake has written a shout-out to a working woman.
Yes.
Saying, you're making your own bread, you're making it on your own, you don't need any help, you know, you're a powerful person in your own right. So it's a kind of an appropriate use of the sample. You know, what I loved about the X Factor song is the way some of the production, the drums on that song, are really innovative. She's using some marching drums on there, as well as the typical hip-hop drums, and it's a very powerful track. But what he's looking for is that hook from Lauryn Hill, X Factor. You said you'd care for me. And it's basically this woman going out into the world and saying, you know, I thought you had my back. You don't. I'm on my own. I'm going to do it on my own. And that's the point of the song. And I think that's one of the reasons it's resonating with people.
Well, it's interesting because this is from the woman side half of Scorpion. And it is an anthem of female empowerment. He's throwing curves in there. Big Frida from New Orleans is on there. It's New Orleans inspired in the same way that the city of New Orleans was struck down hard and is rising up. I mean, it's working on many levels that say, Drake, when you're not just sitting on the couch feeling sorry for yourself, you really got the goods. Here.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Let's play a little bit more of Drake's Nice For What, which is sampling Lauryn Hill's X Factor on Sound Opinion.
That's a real one in your reflection, without a follow, without a mention. You really piping up on these. You gotta be nice for what to these. I understand. You got 100 bands, you got a baby bands, you got some bad friends. High school pics, you was even bad then. You ain't stressing off no lover in the past tense, you already had them. Work at 8 a.m. Round five, all down, you don't see them outside. Yeah, they don't really be the same offline. You know dog days, you know hard times. Doing overtime for the last month. Saturday, call the girls, get them gassed up. Gotta hit the club, gotta make that jump. Gotta hit the club like you hit them angles. With your phone out, snapping like you Fable. And you showing off, but it's alright. And you showing off, but it's alright. It's a short life.
Your boy, Emmy. Watch the breakdown.
We always say on Sound Opinions, everyone is a critic. So what are your thoughts on Scorpion by Drake? Is it worth the attention or is it overhyped? Is it somewhere in between? Call and leave a message on our hotline, 888-859-1800. Coming up, a conversation and a performance from soul artist PJ Morton. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
You know, some people never change their minds.
Things gonna be alright.
But either way, we're gonna be just fine.
Things gonna be alright.
Mm. Even when you try to bring me down.
Things gonna be alright.
You see, I'm still here. Let me adjust my crime.
Things gonna be alright.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and we're hearing a little bit of our guest this week, New Orleans indie soul singer-songwriter PJ Morton. PJ's perhaps better known as the keyboardist in Maroon 5, but his solo work is in a completely different vein. He blends New Orleans gospel roots with strains of Stevie Wonder and other soul artists. In 2017, PJ was nominated for two Grammys, one for the Best R&B Song and one for the Best R&B Album for his record Gumbo.
PJ joined us recently in the Bill and Kay Mabee Performance Studio, and I started our conversation by asking about how his upbringing in New Orleans helped to shape him artistically.
Yeah, well, I grew up a preacher's kid, son of a pastor, and really musical family. My dad is an amazing singer.
You changed my life completely. Now, I really
and so in church is where I really got my training. That's where I cut my teeth, and my dad always had great musicians. Because he was a singer, he always surrounded himself with, like, the best of the best, you know?
Yeah.
So it was just good training ground for me, and got me started.
Well, you're sitting at the piano, PJ.
I am.
And you're going to play some songs from the last album for us? Or what?
Sure,
are you gonna do?
Yeah, I'll play some songs from this album, Gumbo. And,
cool.
Yeah.
Hey, since we were talking about religion, would you play religion at some point?
Sure.
I'll
play it right now if you want.
All right, because the way you were saying that, obviously, you're a person of faith, and it resonates to your core, but this is a song that's talking out about the way people are abusing that now.
Sure, yeah.
I hear it.
I think religion in all forms always start as a good intention thing, you
know?
And then humanity gets in there, and there are ways where, you know, humans make mistakes and are tempted by power and tempted by these things and then start to use religion for personal gain.
Yeah, and to justify actions that hurt other people.
Exactly. Yeah.
Deep.
Yeah. So that's why I wrote that. Yeah. And I'll do that right now. Then.
All right. All right. Thank you.
I don't think I like your religion. Don't always make the best decisions. Yeah, yeah. Not saying you don't have good intentions. I know that you are only human, yeah. But you blame your God when it's your own fault. Where is the love that your God spoke of? Your God had nothing to do with that. 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 Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what you were told. That's just beyond it. You didn't even take the time to find it yourself. Just took their words to be true. Ooh, yeah. You don't even know why you believe what you do. Yeah. But you blame your God when it's your own fault. Where is the love that your God spoke of? Maybe your God had nothing to do with that, yeah. Nothing to do with that. Nothing.
nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it.
Religion from P.J. Morton on Sound Opinions. P.J., the question, religious household, mm-hmm. What does Baptist pastor Paul S. Morton think of that song?
You know, we had actually talked about it. But my father is one of my biggest supporters, you know. My mom's a pastor as well, and she asked me to sing it in church, so she approves. I was inspired to write that actually during the presidential campaign, and I was surprised by a lot of white evangelicals really standing behind a lot of divisive language and banter, and using God as to justify that, and that really struck me. I'm like, I don't know if the God you say you believe in would totally approve.
What artist made the biggest impression on you as a kid growing up?
Well, initially it was gospel artists. So it was, you know, the Winans and Commission and the Clark Sisters.
Am I wasting my time?
Is can the clock be rewind? Have I let my light shine?
And then Stevie Wonder, I got a hold of Stevie, and then it kind of paused everything for a minute when I was about 12. It's all I could listen to. And then I started to get into the others again, like Donnie Hathaway and Al Green, Prince and Michael Jackson. Those were huge for me. And the Beatles, James Taylor. So
you're the age that Stevie was when he started making music, more or less, when you discovered.
When
what
I discovered
was it about
him.
That voice?
Yeah, it's so I knew, you know, I'm an 80s baby, so I knew, like, I just called to say I love you. I knew those records, they were on the radio and stuff. But someone gave me a cassette tape that had I'd Never Dream You'd Leave in Summer. Mm-hmm. And that I hadn't heard that, Stevie.
I never dreamed you'd leave in summer.
Was just like it did something to me immediately, and I went down a rabbit hole. There was a Circuit City by my house, and my dad would give me an allowance weekly, and I would take that allowance and get. I went in chronological order of Stevie records, the earliest I could find, and I would get a new one every week, and just went down that down that hole, and just changed my life really.
So easy now with everything on your phone.
I know, right? Yeah, I had to go to the store every week.
Something about that trick to the record store and deciding which one you were going to buy of what was in the bin.
Yeah. It was very, you had to be make your point to do that. You know what I mean? As opposed to now, you can kind of be passive in that.
Yeah.
This was like deliberate,
Yeah.
You grew up in New Orleans.
Yeah.
You were around 20 when you left. Right?
Mm-hmm. High school, when I graduated, I went to Atlanta and, went to Morehouse College.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you've been associated with some artists that, have tried to write really substantial songs that could potentially change the world. I mean, I'm thinking of India Arie. She had a great start to her career.
Absolutely.
And people have forgotten how terrific those initial few albums that she did were.
Amazing, yeah.
And it toured with Erykah Badu as well, who's still an amazing artist, transformative artist, I think, in many ways.
Yes.
How did you end up working with artists of that caliber?
Yeah, well, India gave me my start in, mainstream music. And it really was a right place, right time thing. Her first record hadn't come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved off campus and lived in this apartment complex. She was living there. There was a piano in the lobby. I was playing the piano. She heard me playing and was like, oh, yeah, I sing. And we started talking about Stevie Wonder. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you sing, you know. So my friend was down
everybody
there.
Everybody sings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm like, fine, okay. we started talking about Stevie Wonder, and she sang Ribbon in the Sky, and I was like, oh, you really sing.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, you sing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that first record was done. It hadn't come out yet, and we just became friends. And so when her next record came around, I was like, Andy, I have a song. Recorded it. It was my first placement on a major label album, you know. And that it happened that quick.
There's a new girl in town. Come to turn it around. I hope that you are down.
Because I'm interested. Can I be a
first album, she was nominated for like 7 Grammys.
Right, yeah.
Same year as Alicia Keys, I think. Mm-hmm. And Alicia swept her.
Yeah.
And but that next album that I was a part of, she was nominated for 2 and won both of them. So it was crazy to immediately jump into the industry and then be right, you know, in Grammy world and all of that. It was a lot. I didn't even know what was happening, really. Erykah Badu, her music director, right when I was graduating school, was a friend of mine. His father was my father's best man, and he asked me if I wanted to come on tour. You know, I wanted to quit college probably about 3 or 4 times. One was when that Grammy happened. I was like, all right, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Still?
What am I wasting my time for?
Yeah. But the other, I used to get all these tours, like, because I was a musician very early, so I would get all these, you know, tours thrown at me, and I was like, man, I got to finish school. Badu came right when I was graduating, and I went out, and that was amazing. My first tour, first time on a tour bus, first time missing church on Sunday.
Wow. I was going to say, because Alan Toussaint was sitting literally right where you are right now a few years ago.
Big influence,
and
man.
He got those huge gigs early on in his life where he just got thrown into the deep end right away.
Yeah.
Like, okay, you're gonna sit in on piano because this guy couldn't make the gig, so you're in.
Yeah.
How do you prepare for that moment when they tap you on the shoulder and say, you're the guy?
Yeah, you know, to be honest, church, especially the way we did church, my father, before Katrina had 20,000 members, you know. So I was playing in front of a lot of people. And things can change really quickly in church. Like, my dad can bring a song that I don't know out in the middle. It is like the most nerve-wracking, and it prepares you for anything, I think. Even with Maroon 5, we've had stuff where something will go wrong, and I'm just like, cool, because I've been through these crazy situations, played totally by ear, you know, and nobody taught me. And I was with Maroon in Brazil at Rock in Rio, and it was 120,000 people, and I saw my reflection in one of these right here, you know, where you could see yourself.
The glass
I'm like, how did I get here exactly?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I don't remember how I was able to, you know, because even the Maroon thing, it was also one of those things that just happened, you know?
Yeah, you and me and all that wine, loosen my tie, lie down, let's fly. Every guy that passes.
PJ, you mentioned Maroon 5. You've been a full-time member of that group since 2012. Tell us how you hooked up with Maroon 5.
Yeah, well, so Maroon 5 was on their third record, Hands All Over. They were looking for another keyboard player / singer.
They need a Billy Preston.
Yeah.
Come in and be the fifth the sixth.
Yeah,
Maroon 5.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But unbeknownst to me, it was actually to be the fifth, because the original keyboard player was planning to leave, and I didn't know that at that time. They all knew I wasn't in on that. But we were together for 2 years before he took a sabbatical. Mm-hmm. The rest was history. We just more vibed on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
I was just straight in there. My first gig was a full live show, live on Fuse. That's kind of been the story of my life, you know, just being prepared for what was thrown.
Cause girls like you run around with guys like me to sundown. When I come through, I need a girl like you, yeah. Girls like you love fun and yeah, me do what I want. When I come through, I need a girl like you,
Well, I want to talk about one other collaboration, and I want to hear about Gumbo.
Okay.
But you got to play us another song first. I put you on the spot before. You play us P. PJ, anything you play us is going to make us happy.
All right, cool. All right. Let me do, well, this, I'm going to do a cover that's on Gumbo, actually. One of my favorite songs of all times by the Bee Gees. And
I know where you're going.
Yeah, I, you know, like I always heard, it always felt soulful to me, but I'm like, I think I can take it a step further in the soul.
You are talking about three white Australians. You
know,
what I mean?
It's like, something about those Aussies, man. No, they got something going.
Maybe. You're talking to two rock critics.
Yeah.
You know? We fight our whole life. We have wrestled over the Bee Gees more than anybody, maybe than Bruce Springsteen.
Sure,
I'm anti,
sure.
He's pro.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Your version, yes.
Yeah,
I ain't going there.
All right, well, listen. They gave me the groundwork for this.
There you go.
Let me do this here. I know your eyes in the morning sun. I feel you touch me in the rain. And the moment that you wander far from me, I wanna feel you in my arms again. And you come to me on a summer breeze, keep me warm in your love, then you softly leave. And it's me you need to show how deep is your love. Is your love how deep? Is your love? I really mean to learn, 'cause we're living in a world of fools, yeah, breaking us down when they all should let us be. We belong to you and me. I believe in you. You know the door to my very soul. You're the light in my deepest, darkest hour. You're my savior when I fall. And you may not think that I care for you, when you know deep down inside I really do. And it's me you need to show. Is your love how deep? Is your love? I really mean to learn, 'cause we're living in a world of fools, yeah, breaking us down when they all should let us be. We belong to you and me.
That is a cool cover.
Thank you.
Of the Bee Gees' How Deep Is Your Love by our guest, PJ Morton, on Sound Opinions. PJ, thanks for funking up the Bee Gees.
The Bee Gees,
which,
yeah,
I didn't think was possible, but I think you just did that in a very soulful way.
Thank you. Thank you.
So that is one of the highlight tracks from your most recent album, Gumbo.
Yeah.
I want to go back one album before that, when you signed with Lil Wayne's Young Money Entertainment.
Yes. Who'd thunk it?
And here you are, the California boy now. You've been out there for X amount of decade plus, but you title that album New Orleans.
Yeah.
And I can't help but feel there was a little homesickness going on there.
I guess so. I think before I even realized it. Like I said, I've always worn New Orleans as a badge of honor. If, you know, it's almost like you don't let out family businesses. You know, it's like I knew that I needed a break from New Orleans, but I'm not letting everybody else know that. You know, I'm proud. But I think now that I look back, I think it was the seed of homesickness happening there.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I made that album in California, I named it New Orleans because I think I was in search for that thing that made me fall in love with music and that freedom. New Orleans, there's such a creative freedom of, like, do whatever you want to do, man. As long as it sounds good, I don't care. As opposed to L.A., where it's like, what's the next smash? Like, where's this hit? What's the next hit? Da, 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 da. So I think I was trying to get back to that, and that's what that album was about.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because, you know, I'm looking at that song Claustrophobic on Gumbo.
Sure.
Where you talk about exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
Would you consider us changing? we're just trying to make you understand. But I must admit, I'm claustrophobic. I have a hard time trying to fit into your small mind.
And it sounded like there was a period of transition, like the industry wanted a PJ Morton that was going to do X, and you're saying, well, wait a minute, I'm Y. This is what I want to do.
Yeah.
So what was the period like between putting out New Orleans on a fairly high-profile label,
mm-hmm.
and then going to the point where you're an indie artist now with your own label, putting out your own record?
We all wanted X at one point, where it's like I was chasing a hit like anybody else, but I think Maroon 5 satisfied a lot of that inside of me. You know, I always wanted to, on my bucket list, I wanted to play SNL. You know, I did it 3 times. I wanted to play the Grammys, did it multiple times. 5 number one hits in a row, you know. So all that stuff that I wanted as a kid, like success in music, I got it. So it made me go internal when it came to my solo stuff. It's like, okay, well, I don't need to chase that anymore. So let me, you know, really figure out what music I want to make and why.
Mm-hmm.
But the flip side of that is then all the success started to happen with Gumbo, the record where I didn't think strategically at all,
mm-hmm.
then the Grammy nominations, and then, then you know what I mean? The streams that I have, like this is the most successful record I've had. And to know that it all I had to do was be myself is like, oh man.
Well, for lack of a better word, you're a soul artist.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that's not like, it's not even a category anymore on the radio. It's like you're an urban artist or, you know, hip hop or whatever.
Exactly.
And, you know, you quote the label executive in Claustrophobic saying, you know, you're not mainstream enough.
Yeah.
What was that, you know, a code for? What do you think, what did they want you to be that you weren't willing to become at that point?
They wanted me to, like, I remember one specific thing was wanting me to work with this producer that was hot on the radio at the time,
mm-hmm.
but stylistically was so far away from anything I'd ever do. But that's what mainstream was code for. It's like, let me give you these drums. I mean, I can actually say it. At that time, a guy was like, you ever consider DJ Mustard? I like DJ Mustard's records, but how do you think me and DJ Mustard mix, you know?
Yeah.
And that was the moment where I was like, okay, they don't care either. Like, they just want a hit. Even friends of mine, like, PJ, just let me give you this hit-sounding song, you know, that can go next to this other urban record.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I don't care to do that, you
mm-hmm.
know? And if I do one day, then cool, you know? But I gotta be able to sleep at night and know that that's authentically me.
Mm-hmm.
You can be yourself later, for now we need the radio.
After a short break, we'll hear more from New Orleans-based indie soul artist PJ Morton. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Cott here with my partner, Jim DeRogatis, and we've been talking to indie soul artist PJ Morton. In addition to his critically acclaimed solo work and his work as a member of Maroon 5, his recent work as a music director for Solange Knowles has brought him a lot of attention. I continued our conversation by asking him about what it's like to work with Solange.
I'm a rebel. Solange... Solange is the king of rebels.
Yeah, she, like, well, she punched Jay-Z.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd say.
Literally. I mean, that's a physical representation of who she is, which is, man, I mean, it's so inspiring to be around her because she literally doesn't care what people think.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, you know. And if she does, she snaps out of it in an hour, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually didn't work on that record, but when she wanted to go on the road, I helped her put the band together. She wanted a heavily New Orleans-based band, so I did auditions. And And a lot of it, we called it co-music director because she had a lot of the vision already. Mm-hmm. But then I made it make sense to the musicians and communicated her thoughts and helped with some arrangements, helped with some transitions. And, you know, her SNL performance I'm still super proud of. Mm-hmm. But I was music director for that. And we did a Super Bowl performance, and we also did a Fallon performance.
Solange.
Fall in your ways so you can crumble. Fall in your ways so you can sleep at night. Fall in your ways so you can wake up today.
And I got to watch it at Essence Fest, you know, proud, knowing that I put this thing together on the heels of this amazing record that she made, you know.
So you can crumble.
That was a spectacularly ambitious show.
Yeah,
I think she played Chicago at Pitchfork that year, and that was not your standard issue.
No, not at all.
R&B show or whatever you want to call it.
Performance art, really.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was fun. I mean, that was fun. I had never experienced anybody who went that far in the performance art, you know, thing, and so it was a challenge for me, but a welcome challenge. You know, it was. I just had come home to New Orleans. She lives in New Orleans. Solange lives in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really just a good release to get my mind off of what I was doing and get to her. And that was right before I started to work on Gumbo. So it was kind of like it probably had something to do with the spirit and the energy.
Well, it's right there in the title, right? Gumbo.
Yeah, yeah,
is it, everything goes in the pot.
Exactly.
And it all comes out as something tasting unique and good. Everybody's got a different gumbo, right?
That's right. That's
I mean,
right.
They take it seriously down there.
Oh, for sure. No, it's a serious deal, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
City, music everywhere.
Yeah.
You're growing up in a musical household. And yet you left. There, you know, I've been reading interviews with you, PJ, where you talked about the need, like you felt like you needed to venture out in order to advance your aspirations to make music professionally.
Yeah, because the thing is, if you're not a jazz musician in New Orleans, there is sort of a ceiling for you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But like to get to another point in your career, you almost had to leave. There wasn't really infrastructure there. Everybody can play something and everybody can sing, you know. So that I was always proud of. But as far as music business and me wanting to write songs and publishing and like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I had to leave.
Did you feel like you're almost doing like a 360 here, coming back to the roots with New Orleans, and you suggesting that you left New Orleans because there was no infrastructure, and here you are back in New Orleans starting your own label.
Yeah, I went back for the reason I left, basically, which is to not, you know, because I think it's great to leave, period. Wherever you're from, it's, you know, it's cool to leave and see other things and learn other things. But I don't want it to be because they have to leave, you know. I want there to be some infrastructure there. And this amazing city who's known for the creation of jazz, you know, like the spirit of innovation is still very much there. And I think it just needs to be, you know, catered to and really, you know, some people need to pay attention to it.
Your dad's church was 20,000 members strong at its peak, and then Hurricane Katrina hit. How hard did that storm hit you and your family and the church?
I mean, big time, man. It separated people.
Is it back?
So, I mean, it's very much back. I don't think it'll ever be what it was in that way, you know, 25,000 members, because it was such a—
Wow.
My father was pastoring for 30 years there at that point. For better or for worse, really, I think it's a good thing, too. Like, you know, restarts are good.
Let's build it new together.
Yeah, exactly.
So your label's part of that.
Yeah, I mean, Morton Records is just part, I think, of the fabric of New Orleans now. I've been mm-hmm. back 2.5 years, and people know I'm back. You know, a lot of times people come back after their careers have slowed down. Right. I really want to be back, and mm-hmm. I really want to help build the city and do my part, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We are here with P.J. Morton on Sound Opinions. P.J., have you got another song you can play for us?
I do. I have a few songs I could play. Yeah. All right. Yeah, let me do. So, you know, Gumbo was nominated for 2 Grammys this year, and one was for Best R&B Album, but this the next one was for Best R&B Song. So I'm going to do that one first, Begin. He goes,
no one makes me feel the way you do inside, and I don't know what I would do without you, and that's no lie. If I die, I'd hope to find you in another life, so we could fall again, be the way we were when we first began, like the first time that I ever saw you smile. I want that feeling again, to be the way we were when we first began. Yes, we've got something special, let's hold. Oh, don't, and don't let go, yeah. Yeah. And I'll never find another like you in this unknown. If I die, I'd hope to find you in another life, so we could fall again, be the way we were when we first began, like the first time I ever saw you smile. Give me that feeling again, to be the way we were when we first began.
First Began by yes, P.J. Morton, live on Sound Opinions.
Yeah.
Man, I love that. When you're writing a song like that, mm-hmm. how do you decide to do that thing where you go from the real gentle melody and then you kick it in?
Yeah.
Like, how does that, is that just like, I got this hanging here and I got that hanging there? What happens if I put them together?
Yeah, no.
Or
that had different a bunch of different lives.
Mm-hmm.
It started off first, you know, straight into the beat. No one mm-hmm. makes me feel... And then I was like, I started to do it live. Mm-hmm. That's what happened. I went on the road and did it live and saw the response when I played it slow like that in the mm-hmm. beginning. And when we dropped into the beat, and I was like, guys, we got to go back in the studio and record it. This is the way to do it. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
So many bands don't understand yeah. that by playing stuff in live performance, mm-hmm. you come to a understanding of it that nothing else can do.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the reason why I did Gumbo, then came back and did Gumbo Unplugged, right?
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, that moves people, and you can't know that in the studio.
Right.
You're trusting your instinct, you know, and you do the best you can. But that instant gratification of, oh man, they responded to that.
Mm-hmm.
That you can't. It's nothing that compares to that.
Yeah.
And no better teacher than that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we have been talking with P.J. Morton, who's regaled us with some beautiful tunes and some great conversation. P.J., thanks for coming in.
Oh, man, thank you so much for having me. Been a pleasure talking to you guys.
Could have done this all day.
Yeah, man. Mm-hmm.
You don't know what you do to me. Only you make my life complete.
That wraps up our interview with P.J. Morton. Greg, what is on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, an in-depth career overview with the one and only Alice Cooper.
to us, it just made us madder and made us more irritable and made us work harder. I think other bands would rehearse 2 hours a day. We rehearsed 9 hours a day. Mm. And 8 hours was on the music and one was on the theatrics.
I used to be such a sweet, sweet thing till they got a hold of me. I opened doors for little old ladies. I helped the blind to see. I got no friends.
So I think it made us work harder to get people to respect our playing ability. We had to overcome the visual thing. They all loved the show. But, you know, a lot of the critics said, well, take the show away, and what are they?
No more Mr. Nice Guy. No more Mr. Clean. No more Mr. Nice Guy, they say. He's sick, he's obscene.
For more Sound Opinions, subscribe to our podcast, available wherever you download them. Special thanks this week to Colin Ashmead Bobbitt for engineering our PJ Morton performance. Sound Opinions is produced by Brendan Banaszak, Alex Claiborne, Ayanna Contreras, Andrew Gill, and we have an intern, Hannah Edgar.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
Hey guys, this is Allison from St. Louis. I'm like a month behind. I was just listening to your Anxious Anthems episode and wanted to talk for a sec about Transgender Dysphoria Blues by Against Me. I've been listening to that album for years, long before I knew I was transgender, but the title track really hits my specific anxieties about like how other people see me. You know, the really aggressive drums and the really, just everything is so aggressive. It gets me. Bye.
I was listening to your show with Ari Melber, who I watch quite a bit. You wanted an opinion on his rap reference. I love Ari Melber. I really do. But honestly, he just sounds like the dorkiest white guy when he does that. I am so embarrassed every time he does it.
A wise man told me don't argue with fools because people from a distance can't tell who is who.
Plead the fifth when it comes to the fam. I'm like a dog. I never speak, but I understand.
Nobody knows what he's talking about. Nobody knows what he's referring to. I mean, I'm 55 years old and I know what he's referring to. I mean, I get it. Okay. But yeah, it's like the white guy that's at the party with all the black guys and says something really stupid. That's kind of what he looks like. Love you, Ari, though. I really do. I wish you'd stop doing that. Thanks.
Jim and Greg, my name's Brett. I'm calling from North Riverside, Illinois. I just heard the episode with Ari Melber from MSNBC. Really, really interesting. And the guy sounds like encyclopedic in his knowledge of rap lyrics. But I was thinking throughout that interview of Hank Williams Jr.'s A Country Boy Can Survive.
We came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the Western skies. And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
I think if you were to study what Hank Williams Jr. is singing about is exactly the sort of posture that we see in the reactionary right today. Not that the guy should be quoting Hank Williams Jr., but I just wonder as music critics, I thought there was maybe an opportunity there to say, how do you get at the other side? Certainly, this guy's quoting of hip-hop in obscure detail, as you note, is going to go over the head of a lot of the people listening and some of the people on the show, and it's going to resonate most with people who are already participating in the resistance. Anyway, thanks for your time. Always enjoy the show. You guys take care. Bye.
Hey, guys. Sam here in Ridgeway, Colorado, calling about your Best of the Year so far episode. Really enjoyed it. Had Sarah Shook on repeat since then. I'm listening a lot these days to Angelique Kidjo's reimagining of the 1980 classic by the Talking Heads, Remain in Light.
Letting the days go by. Letting the days go by.
This album is both an homage to those really great Talking Heads songs of the early 80s, but also a comment on those songs by adding a certain amount of polyrhythmic complexity. And by quoting Fela Kuti, Angelique Kidjo reminds us that we're always evolving towards Africa. The album is a complete reimagining and rethinking of the album, and at the same time, same as it ever was. Thanks, guys. Take care.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.